Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Chris Kelly.
And I'm Dave Pablo. Today, we start with a segment about the rally and march on Sunday in Troy, organized by Never Again.
Then we hear from Joe Seaman about more about the rally in late August to shut down detention centers in Glens Falls.
Later on, we get a segment on voter suppression in Rensselaer County.
And after that, we have a discussion about the Venezuelan embassy sit-in.
Finally, we will hear a segment about the Waterford Museum and Historical Society. But first, let's start with today's news.
The Times Union reports that Albany County Sheriff Craig Apple plans to offer space in the jail as transitional housing for homeless individuals. Apple said that that as the jail's daily population falls, he wants to put the extra space to good use. The jail's average population has fallen from 833 people in 2014 to 470 this year. The jail's population is expected to fall further when new bail reform laws take effect in January.
More than 200 people blocked off the intersection in front of the Rensselaer County Jail Sunday in Troy to protest the sheriff's policy to hand over inmates who have an immigration hold on to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The protest was organized by the Jewish organization Never Again. Rensselaer is the only county in New York State participating in the federal 287-G program. Never Again supports the elimination of ICE and speaks out against the treatment of immigrants at the U.S. border.
The Times Union reports that the civil rights lawsuit filed against the city of Troy and Sergeant Randall French, who fatally shot an unarmed DUI suspect in 2016, moved forward to trial on Friday when a federal magistrate declined to dismiss the case and ruled that a jury should resolve the, quote, material questions of fact, unquote, about what really happened that night. The judge noted, quote, the clearest dispute of fact is presented by witness Philip Gross's testimony that he observed Sergeant French get out of his vehicle and, without saying anything, without being pinned, immediately start firing into Thevenin's vehicle. Gross alternatively placed the Thevenin vehicle backing away from French when the shots were initially fired.
The Shop, a gastropub in downtown Troy, has suddenly shut its doors after the entire staff resigned on Sunday, citing communications and other issues with the owner, Kevin Blodgett, according to the Times Union. According to a former employee, this was long in the making, as most of the 26 staff had already secured a new job. On the Shop's Instagram, there was a farewell post, a picture of a chalkboard that normally reads the specials, with the words, "Do better. Please."
In other local restaurant news, Troy Kitchen, a food hall and restaurant incubator that opened 3.5 years ago in Troy, is expanding to Albany this fall with its first sibling location, Albany Kitchen, in downtown Albany. There will be 8 restaurant stalls, each independently operated and with its own kitchen area on the upper floor, with seating, bar, and stage on the street level / basement room. An opening in late October or early November is projected. For those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a lingering illness, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. For our first segment today, we hear from correspondents Melissa Bromley and Mark Dunley, who covered the protest against Rensselaer County Sheriff Pat Russo and ICE's treatment of immigrants and children at a rally on September 8th in Troy. The rally and march to the county jail were organized by the Jewish organization Never Again. We hear from Miriam Axelut, Rachel Glick, Ivy West, Rabbi Matt Cutler, and Karen Beadle.
My name is Miriam Axelut, and I'm here because things have gotten so bad in the treatment of immigrants in this country that I couldn't not be in the streets. I was part of the group that organized this event.
Is that a specific group or a number of people coming together?
It's just a number of individual people in the region who came together to organize this.
This is a big turnout. What do you attribute to that?
I think there's an incredible hunger right now. There's so many people who have been heartbroken to see the stories about what's been happening at the border, what's happening in these camps, the deaths of the children, and there's just a deep need to do something that feels commensurate to what's going on.
What do you hope will be the outcome of today's event?
Well, obviously we hope that Sheriff Russo will stop cooperating with ICE, and we hope that we join the Never Again movement to create national momentum to change the way that we're dealing with immigrants. I also hope that other people in the Capital Region and beyond will see that we're out here and be moved to act.
Can you tell me more about the Never Again movement?
Sure. So in June, so it's very young, in June, a group of Jews and immigrant rights organizers in New Jersey started the first one. They blocked an ICE detention center in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and with this theme of Never Again.
What's your name and why are you here?
My name's Rachel Glick. I'm here because I am Jewish, and for a long time I've been taught that we've been oppressed for a long time, and when any group is oppressed, then all minorities need to step up, especially Jews. We talk about the Holocaust and we talk about never again, and now is the time to take action. I'm also a Troy resident, and so Sheriff Russo should be answering to his constituents, and I'm one of them, and so many of us are here to protest the ICE collaboration that he's been engaging in.
And as we're talking, you're sitting in the middle of the streets. Can you tell me more about that?
So we're sitting in the street blocking the Rensselaer County Jail. We want to make them notice us. We want to disrupt business as usual because this should not be business as usual. This is a great way to stop them, make them listen to us. And this is what we can do.
So you and how many people are blocking the roadway here?
Maybe like 25.
We hear now from Ivy Hest.
And an end to the inhumane conditions immigrants face in this country. And we are here today because these atrocities are not only happening at our borders, they are happening in our backyard. Our Rensselaer County Sheriff, Patrick Russo, is complicit in the family separation and dehumanizing of immigrants. In 2017, Sheriff Russo voluntarily signed 287G, officially giving some of his staff the power to act as ICE agents within the jail and check for ICE holds. That means that people who would otherwise be released are imprisoned, or they're being picked up by ICE as soon as they're released. This does not make anyone safer.
Shame.
It only violates due process and wastes county time carrying out ICE's goals for them. He's the only sheriff, the only one in the entire state who has signed on to this agreement. He's only one of 79 in the whole country.
Boo!
Leaders across party lines asked Russo to withdraw his application and refuse to participate, but he went ahead with it. He never held any public forums to seek community input on this decision. Why? He said, quote, "I'm just not going to host public forums because they become Chinese fire drills."
Boo!
We care. He said, quote, "I don't think I got 20 people that bashed 287G. People like it in Rensselaer County. Do we like it?
No!
Do we want him to continue collaborating with ICE?
No!
Rensselaer County Jail also houses undocumented people for ICE while they wait to be transferred to a more permanent detention center. By participating in this program, he profits off of immigrant bodies. But he does not want undocumented immigrants to be in this county. He believes releasing any undocumented person into the general population is, quote, a violation of his oath of office. Are we afraid of our immigrant neighbors?
No!
Those policies and statements put him squarely on the side of ICE and the atrocities that it is committing against immigrants and refugees. He is on the side of concentration camps and children imprisoned and separated from their families. He is on the side of dehumanizing and imprisoning people whose only crime is to be our neighbors. Sheriff Rousseau, which side are you on? Our demands are simple. Say them after me. End participation in 287G.
End participation in 287G.
Stop collaborating with ICE.
Stop collaborating with ICE.
Stop profiting off of immigrant bodies.
Stop profiting off of immigrant bodies.
For these reasons, we stand here together today to say no to ICE. And we will be delivering that message to the Rensselaer County Sheriff's Department.
Never again means abolish ICE. Never again means close the camp. Never again by an IEA. Never again is now.
Up next is Rabbi Matt Cutler of Schenectady, who reads off the names of children who have died in ICE custody.
Leon Guitrez, who was 16. Felipe Gomez Alonso, age 8. Darlin Valle, 10. Carlos Giorgio Hernandez Vasquez, 16. Jacqueline Kaal McQueen, 7. Marie Juarez, 1. Wilmer Jose Ramirez Vasquez, 2 years old.
The incarceration of today, to Japanese internment during World War II, to boarding camps and ethnic cleansing of indigenous people, to the enslavement of kidnapped Africans, this country has a long history of violently imprisoning and tearing families of color apart. Today, we walk through a city that perpetuates this. We stand not far from where Officer Randall French murdered Edson Thevenin. We stand not far from where Officer Gerald Eiler horrifically wounded Damique McDonald. We stand in a neighborhood where black people are regularly harassed and harmed by the same factors of white supremacy that breed ICE and have bred white nationalism, xenophobia, gentrification, and genocide. We gather here today to ask, will we allow this moment to be yet another chapter in American history? Or will we disrupt it with every tool that we have?
What's your name and what brings you here today?
My name is Karen Beadle, and I'm here because I'm a family therapist. And if we don't speak out as mental health professionals about what's happening to families and children, we don't deserve to be licensed in this state.
What's going on around us?
What's happening today is that people are going to shut down business as usual at the Rensselaer County Jail, which is a really critical part of making a statement that we can't act like nothing is happening when we're seeing conditions that are profoundly dangerous to families and children, to the integrity of community, to diversity in our country, that we're really called to act. Well, I was a human rights protector in Guatemala in 1986 and in El Salvador in 1988. So the folks who are coming across the border are largely the grandchildren of people who I was working to protect who had disappeared family members in Guatemala in the 1980s. So the United States has a very long history of disrupting governments in Central America, which is what causes warlike conditions, economic deprivation, and drug cartels at this point. So I'm here because I'm not going to forget what I saw in Guatemala, and those people deserve to be understood as asylum seekers. So on Thursday at West Capitol Park, there's going to be a demonstration of mental health professionals speaking out about the separation of children and families. So I just want to encourage any mental health professionals and any allies, human service allies, family members to come out and raise their voices about family separation, but about human rights abuses at the border in general.
You just heard coverage of the rally by Never Again on Sunday in Troy, protesting ICE's treatment of immigrants and children.
Joe Seaman, a longtime Capital Region-based political activist, attended the rally to shut down detention centers in Glens Falls and spoke with WOOC correspondent Aaron Pednotti about the event. This segment was recorded just after the main rally had ended, and several organizers of the event were occupying Congresswoman Elise Stefanik's office. The conversation was recorded just outside the office as this act of civil disobedience unfolded.
This is Aaron Pettinati, and I am talking to you from the rally to end detention centers in Glens Falls, New York. Right now, I am at a civil disobedience event with the longtime Capital Region-based activist, Joe Seaman, who is providing support at the event. You're not actually engaged in the civil disobedience?
I have committed civil disobedience, not doing it today, but we're here to support the people who are. And for those of you who think about civil disobedience, you don't have to actually commit civil disobedience to be there to support other people who are.
Civil disobedience ally, essentially.
Okay, yeah. That's a good word.
Right. So what's this event about and why have you come to it?
Well, we just had a big rally with a lot of people to close the camps. And we're here at Congresswoman Stefanik's office because Congresswoman Stefanik supports Trump and keeps him in power. And she's responsible for these camps where kids are being torn away from their parents and put in cages. And if Congresswoman Stefanik would denounce Trump, would drop her support for Trump, if so-called moderates, she's not really moderate, but she calls herself one, or so-called bipartisans, as she pretends to be, would drop their support for Trump, he would be gone in a day. So the reason that Trump is in office, the reason we have these horrors, there's a whole host of ours, but the ones we're talking about today are concentration camps where children of asylum seekers legally seeking asylum, children are being torn away from their parents and put in cages in horrific conditions. We're causing tremendous trauma for people for their whole lives. There are horrors being committed, and we're here to tell Congresswoman Stefanik we hold her responsible. She and Congress, especially the Republicans in Congress, must stop this, must close the camps.
And we've got members of the DSA and the Saratoga Peace Alliance inside, and their intention is to get arrested, correct?
Their intention is to sit and not to leave. They want to sit there until something is done. And if nothing is done, they will not leave. And if they will be arrested, so be it.
And among them is Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org, the world-renowned climate activist.
That's right. And a number of local activists here from the area around Warren counties and Saratoga counties.
So what's your sense of the value and the power of events like this?
Well, frankly, one of our problems is the media likes to report on the horse races and lots of other things that aren't about the horrors, and this is a way to call attention. We have had many rallies. Sometimes the media covers them, sometimes they don't. But if people get arrested, it will make the news and will make a point. The point is that the people of America do not support this. Yes, there were some Trumpers here who actually were in support of concentration camps. No kidding. And when we sang God Bless America, they tried to drown us out with a siren. When we sang This Land Is Your Land, when we sang America the Beautiful, they didn't join us in song. They tried to drown us out. So, yes, there are some Trumpers, but there are many more of us, and we will stand united. We will defeat Trump in 2020, and we will try to defeat Trumpism, the party of hate, in every election that we can.
It was interesting when This Land Is Your Land first started up, I perceived a certain confusion among the Trumpers. First, is this a patriotic song? And if so, should we stop screaming and chanting and blaring the siren on the microphone that we've brought with us? And they seemed pretty confused about the answers to both of those questions.
Well, that's a good sign when people are members of a cult, as the followers of our illegitimate president are. When people remember a cult, a little bit of confusion is perhaps movement in the right direction.
Can you just comment on what you felt looking into the faces and hearing the voices of that crowd?
I'm sorry, I dealt with people. I won't use the word that's probably wouldn't be allowed to be put on the radio during normal hours, but I've dealt with people like this when I was a kid. When I was in junior high school, there were bullies in the playground, and I felt the exact same way now with these bullies, these supporters of hatred, supporters of fascism, as when I was a kid. And I'm sorry they didn't grow up. Many of us have. And it's a challenging situation. We are all committed to nonviolence. Rabbi Linda Motzkin led us in a pledge of nonviolence before we began our rally and our march today. And practicing nonviolence is a daily challenge to all of us, even those of us who've been working for peace and justice. Is still a challenge. So that's something we all had to deal with. And look, my point is that I don't hate the Trumpers. I don't even view them as the enemies or opponents. Okay? They are potentially allies. They are, most of them, I don't think they're billionaires. The billionaires, yes, Trump is certainly in their interest, and fascism is in their interest. But anybody who's part of the 99% of us who can't afford high-priced lobbyists and making huge contributions to bribe politicians, whether they know it or not, they're on the same side as us.
And after all of the decades of organizing and activism that you've been a part of, both in this area and in a broader sense, you know, you've been organizing about local issues, but also about national and world issues. What's your sense of the future? How do you feel?
Oh, good question. I feel optimistic in spirit, not necessarily optimistic in what's going to happen. That remains to be seen. I mean, we need to fight. We need everybody who hears this to get up off your behind. And if you're in the capital region of upstate New York, in 2020, maybe you can get to Pennsylvania, swing state, and help us defeat Trump there. And if you can't, if that's too much for you, that's okay. Maybe you can find a local election for Congress, for state senate, for state assembly. I'm going to be involved in that as best I can. And I ask everyone to do what you can and find what you can. If you can come to a rally for an hour, that's great. If you can write a letter to the editor, that's great. If you can volunteer for a campaign, knock on a door, make a contribution. You've got to remember that the Republicans are the party of the billionaire class. So they've got money from billionaires who want them to give more tax cuts to the billionaires and more welfare to corporations. So if you can make a small contribution, if you can get out and march, if you can knock on a door, connect. I want you to consider going to a website wherever you are in America. Go to indivisible.org. Yes, we are indivisible. We stand indivisible. And find a local indivisible group. Here in our region, we have a group called the Saratoga Progressive Action. I'm a member, and you can find us on Facebook, Saratoga Progressive Action. And wherever you are in the capital region, there are many, many groups, a number of groups represented today. Find a group, get involved, do what you can. Our country is not going to be healed, it's not going to be protected from the invasion. No, it's not an invasion of immigrants, it's a cyber invasion by Putin and his oligarchs. They've cyber invaded America, waged cyber war on America in 2016. As Robert Mueller said, they're doing it every day as we speak. So we're not going to stop this by doing nothing. We're going to need each of us to do what we can.
Well, thanks very much, Joe. I see the police are now walking into the office, so we're going to go in and see what happens.
Immediately after this interview, the police entered Representative Stefanik's office and arrested the protesters who were occupying it. As I mentioned during my talk with Joe, the renowned environmentalist Bill McKibben was among this group. The following day, Bill published a piece in The New Yorker in which he explained his reasons for engaging in this act of civil disobedience. If you are interested in reading it, just Google Bill McKibben, The New Yorker, Glens Falls, and it will pop right up.
And that was Aaron Pettinati speaking to Joe Seaman at the rally to shut down detention centers in Glens Falls.
For those just tuning in, I'm Dave Pueblo.
And I'm Chris Skelly. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or want to become a local reporter or radio host, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazzy jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. In our next segment, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with Melanie Trimble, executive director of the Capital Region chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union, about voter suppression in Rensselaer County.
I saw an article in the paper about the NYCLU and voter suppression efforts in Rensselaer County. Can you just fill us in? What is the issue there?
Well, the state just passed legislation that allows for early voting in counties across the state. And each county has to decide how many polling places they will offer for early voting and where they're going to place them. Rensselaer County has chosen, they selected two based upon their population. They have chosen two early voting sites, but the sites that they have chosen are outside the city of Troy, which happens to be the county seat and also the highest density of population, and also the higher density of people of color and other minorities. So we were concerned that they chose two polling sites, one of which is not accessible by public transportation at all, and both are in predominantly white neighborhoods. So the whole point of early voting was to enfranchise traditionally disenfranchised communities, and the county's efforts are to reflect early voting certainly are not complying with that desire. So we wrote to the Board of Elections requesting that they find a polling place in Troy, which they have failed to explain exactly why they haven't chosen one. There are also a lot of other community groups around the city of Troy that have been very active in trying to compel the Rensselaer County Board of Elections to choose these sites, as well as some not just city officials, but groups outside like the NAACP. So other community groups are very interested in getting the city to... Oh, and also the city council, I'm sorry, has asked that the county find polling sites within the city for early voting. They offered actually some funding for it, and we're hoping that the county would match funds, which they refused to do. So we're very interested in continuing negotiating with the counties to get them to recognize that early voting was meant to help disenfranchised voters vote, and that putting a polling place in Troy is essential to do that.
So if you ascribe the best possible motivations to the Board of Elections, what would their rationale be for having the places where they put them?
Well, there's very little rationale for where they've actually chosen to place them. We have suggested that they use the Board of Elections in downtown Troy, which is a regular polling place. It is handicapped accessible. It has all the necessary conditions to provide an adequate early voting place. So that will be part of our negotiations with the county to offer that. We may not be in time in our negotiations to do it for this fall's election process, but we certainly will try for the 2020 election cycle. There's also another aspect of suppression in voting in Rensselaer County, which I should mention, and that is that with the new passage of the state law that allows for driver's licenses to be offered to undocumented individuals, Rensselaer County has chosen, number one, to sue the state over this law, claiming that it is unconstitutional, and also has the county executive, along with the county clerk, have publicly declared that they will not abide by the law, or if they have to abide by the law, they are going to turn DMV records over to ICE. We know that turning those records over is not legal, and we will certainly confront the county if they do so, but we did submit a FOIL to find out exactly what their rationale was in doing so and to what kind of legal references they're referring that they think they're able to do this. And the county has not been able to respond with a legitimate reason for doing so and whether or not they are, in fact, going to do it. As a matter of fact, they've never even demonstrated that there has been any fraudulent voting on the part of people who are not documented, or even people who are documented, whether or not there's any fraud at all in the voting rolls at Rensselaer County. So we're skeptical. We know that we feel that the county is doing this to intimidate people. Can be no other reason to pronounce that they will be turning records over to ICE. It's merely a smokescreen to discourage people from registering to vote. So we have a lot of concerns. We'll be negotiating with the county. We've already started some discussions with them, and we hope that they will back off. This is not something that's American, not acceptable at all to be intimidating voters. And it does, in fact, intimidate regular voters, people who are documented and have been here for years and have been voting all along. There is still a chilling effect that the language that comes out of the county executive's office and the county clerk's office that intimidates even registered and regular voters. You know, when you feel as though you're going to be, whether the government is going to come down and actually scrutinize the polling places and look for people that they might be able to bring up on charges is just outrageous. So we want to stop that as much as we can.
Is this something that's only happening in Rensselaer County in New York State?
To our knowledge, they're the only county. There are two other counties that have entered the lawsuit to try and declare the driver's licenses by undocumented workers. And we'll see how that turns out, although we feel that the law has been written in such a way that it is not challengeable and we will prevail. The other two counties, I am not sure whether they've used intimidation tactics to the same extent that McLaughlin and the county clerk here in Rensselaer County have.
So the something about early voting. What actually is that? What does that mean?
Well, early voting, I think it's 8 days ahead of the actual date of voting. You have, well, in each county, they will be assigned by how many polling places will be determined by what the population of the county is. And, of course, the placement of those polling places are very important to make sure that traditionally disenfranchised voters are able to vote. And based upon the number of polling places, they will be open. There has to be evening hours and there has to be weekend hours incorporated, but each county can choose what days and times they're going to open. They are provided money by the state to do so. So people should look out for that. If they want to be able to vote, they can call their board of elections in the county, and they will be notified of where these polling places are, what the times are, and how they actually submit a ballot.
So Rensselaer County is predominantly Republican. The county executive is Republican, the clerk of courts. Presumably there's something about that you think is driving the resistance to early voting?
Yeah, and we're surprised, too, that the Democratic, of course, the Board of Elections is made up of an equal number of Democrats and Republicans, and it's a mystery to us as to why the Democratic candidates on that Board of Elections haven't been more vocal in resisting the assignment of the polling places being placed outside of the city of Troy. But nonetheless, the city really has to look at its population densities and understand that the law requires them to be in those population dense areas for at least one of the polling places that they choose. So even though it may appear that the county is trying to suppress the votes of minorities, doesn't matter to us. They need to follow the law as it's stated in the early voting requirements that were passed by the state.
So what's the next step on this?
Well, the next step are a lot of negotiations. We're considering all of our options, including our legal options with the county. All of this takes time, and so we're warning people that for early voting this election cycle, we may not be able to succeed. We're hoping that the county, sees that the polling places that they've chosen are not appropriate, that one should be in the city of Troy, and that they will voluntarily change the voting location. But if not, we'll see what we can do to compel the county to do so. The county has, done some things that are very concerning to the people in the state of New York. It's certainly not as progressive. We think it's actually even regressive in some of its political stands of late. And so we hope that the communities get together and start talking to their county legislators and making it clear what their positions are so that they feel like they're in a friendly county that's welcoming to people instead of one that wants to shut their border down.
And that was Steve Pierce speaking with Melanie Trimble about voter suppression in Rensselaer County.
And now we have the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry. He attended the James Connolly Forum on Solidarity with Venezuela and the Sanctions and U.S. Hands-Off at the Oakwood Community Center on September 5th in Troy. In his segment, you will hear his interview with speakers Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese of Popular Resistance about why they stage a sit-in in the Venezuelan embassy.
Willie Terry from WOOC, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, at the John Connolly Forum at the Oakwood Community Center in Troy, New York, where there's a forum entitled Solidarity with Venezuela, End the Sanctions, U.S. Hands Off. And the speaker are Margaret Flower and Kevin Zeese, and they're from the Popular Resistance Organization.
That's right.
So how y'all doing?
We're doing well. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Well, one of the questions I'm going to ask you off the bat is that why should the people of Troy and in the Capital District here in Albany area be concerned about the struggle in Venezuela? Because that's what people are saying. All the things that we're concerned with and problems we have, why should we be concerned about Venezuela?
Well, I would say a couple of reasons that I can think of right away. One is that we have a lot to learn from Venezuela. Venezuela is the example of a country that actually puts human rights into their constitution, the right to vote. They've reduced poverty significantly. They provide health care to everyone, housing, education. And these are things that we could learn about how to do this in our own country. But also because, you know, what the U.S. is doing in Venezuela is in violation of international law. And we, as people in the United States, should be concerned that our country is violating international law and in a way that's actually harming people of another country. How can we be proud of a country that's doing something like that?
I would just add that all these issues are connected. The fact that the United States is spending 65% of its federal discretionary spending on the military and on these kinds of foreign endeavors of regime change around the world means there's less money for the necessities of the people in the United States. It's why our education system is underfunded, why our health care is underfunded. It's why we see homelessness and poverty at high levels. These are connected issues. And as Margaret said, we can learn a lot from Venezuela. Now, that must sound very strange to people because we are told the opposite of the truth in the United States. Venezuela is actually a very hyper-democracy. It's not a dictatorship. It's actually very focused on uplifting its poorest economically, providing housing and health care and food supplies. It's the opposite, we're told. So we should care because it impacts our lives here, to spend that money there, and because it impacts us that we're being lied to every day by our corporate media and by the bipartisans in Washington, D.C.
So what is the U.S. policy towards Venezuela?
Well, prior to Hugo Chavez being elected in 1998, Venezuela is a very wealthy country. It has the largest oil reserves, some of the largest gas reserves, largest in gold and diamond and many other rare minerals. And that was all being, you know, exploited by the business class. And there was extreme wealth, and then there was also extreme poverty. But under Hugo Chavez, he started using the resources to actually lift up the people. And the United States, ever since that has happened, has been trying to undermine that process. They call it the Bolivarian process after Simon Bolivar, the great liberator. And the United States, you know, for whatever reasons, because they want access back to those resources again to exploit them. They don't want this good example to catch on and others to learn about what they're doing. We've been investing in multiple attempts at coups, these illegal, they're called unilateral coercive measures. We call them sanctions, but they're basically to try to really squeeze the economy there and try to cause civil unrest there to give the U.S. a reason to go in and intervene. So our policy has been very much intervention in their political process, trying to overthrow their government, and threats of military aggression, and now attacking their infrastructure. And Elliot Abrams told the foreign minister of Venezuela, "This is we're playing the long game here. We're not giving up."
So, what is the current state of Venezuela at this point? You know, due to the U.S. foreign policy.
Well, President Maduro is still a president. The coup attempt has failed. It's failed, and I say that multiple times because they've tried multiple times, and every time they've tried, they have failed. President Maduro is still the president. There's an economic war going on between the U.S. and Venezuela. We're essentially starving their people out, denying them medicines. A recent report by the Center for Economic and Policy Research put out a report that said that 40,000 Venezuelans in the last 2 years have died because of the U.S. economic sanctions, the illegal unilateral coercive measures. 40,000 deaths. So it's a struggling situation, but Venezuelan people are unified in that they will not be under the control of the United States again. They went through that once before. They know what it's like to be controlled by the largest empire in world history and abused and have their resources stolen by the U.S. empire. They're not going to let it happen.
But if I could add very quickly, despite, you know, even with these economic measures against them, they're continuing to build what they call social housing. You won't find homeless people in Venezuela. They've built over 2 million units of social housing. They have a food program where they deliver boxes of food once or twice a month to more than 6 million families in the country. This is a country that has 30 million people, so 6 million families is a huge proportion of the country. They provide health care. They've built new universities. They have new schools. So they're, even with this, they're doing what they can to meet the basic needs of their people.
Okay. Now, you know, right now they're talking about the election for next year, and you got a whole lot of candidates that's running. You know, the crop of candidates running, I think a lot of them in the Democrat Party. Now, if one of those candidates was to get elected, or if the Democrat was to get in, do you see any difference in terms of policy towards Venezuela?
Well, the policy towards Venezuela since Hugo Chavez was elected has survived both Democrats and Republicans. It was President Obama who declared Venezuelan to be a national security threat to the United States and put in place very aggressive sanctions, the unilateral coercive measures, and President Trump has built on that. Now, there are some things that have been said by some of the Democrats that have been more positive than what Trump is doing, but what's going to make the change happen in Venezuela is for people in the United States to be organized and demanding that U.S. stop these interventions around the world, and this regime change effort in Venezuela, which has failed and failed, needs to end. We need to stop intervening, allow Venezuela to have its sovereignty, its independence, and we can negotiate with them. The United States can negotiate with them for trade, but we should not be trying to steal their oil, steal their rare earth minerals that would be used for weapons and for electronics. The United States has to stop that approach, but it's going to take the people demanding it. Mm-hmm. Don't count on it coming from just an election.
Okay. So now, just tell me a little bit about the embassy protest that you were involved in.
Sure. So the United States, after we backed this coup person, Juan Guaido, who declared himself president back in January, started handing over assets that belonged to the Venezuelan government to Juan Guaido and his people. And one of the things that they started handing over were embassies. They handed over the consulate in New York, as well as some military attaché offices in D.C. They couldn't give the embassy in Georgetown away because there were still diplomats there, Venezuelan diplomats, that were under the Organization of American States. But the OAS changed its rules in April and forced through a vote to recognize Juan Guaido, and then the State Department ejected those diplomats, so they had to leave the country. And so we knew at that point that the U.S. was going to hand that property over to the Juan Guaido. And so we went there with other groups, other people, and said we would like to stay in the embassy, because when it happened in the other properties, people tried to get there and stop it, but they were on the outside. They couldn't stop it. So we thought, well, if we're in the inside, we can stop it. And so we were there for 37 days with the permission of the Venezuelan government. The United States government was not allowed legally to come in under the Vienna Convention and take us out. So they tried to scare us out. They brought in all these right-wing, violent people that surrounded us and blocked our food. They cut off our power. They cut off our water. And we still refused to leave because we didn't want the United States to violate the Vienna Convention. We wanted the U.S. and Venezuela to agree, as we've done, all countries have done throughout millennia, to have another country serve as a protecting power for their embassy when relationships break down. So we were trying to be interim protectors until those agreements could be reached. But instead, on May 16th, the U.S. police basically raided the Venezuelan embassy and arrested us.
Now, if people want to support you in your effort in terms of your struggle, what could they do?
Well, there's a Embassy Protector Defense Committee that's been formed. That's defendembassyprotectors.org. We're trying to raise money for our legal defense as we go through this federal prosecution. And we also have a petition going right now asking the Department of Justice to drop the charges.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's next?
Well, that's a great question. We're planning a big mobilization when the General Assembly meets in New York City, September 20th to 23rd. We're going to be having a series of events. The first day will be a climate strike we're part of. We're bringing the issue of militarization to the climate struggle. And then on the 22nd is a major mobilization against militarism to save the planet. And then on the 23rd is an important event that night, bringing together countries that have been impacted by U.S. sanctions, as well as civil society fighting against those sanctions and to try to push the United States to obey international law rather than continue to violate it.
And that website where you can get all that information is peoplesmobe.org.
Okay. All right. There you have it. Margaret Flowers and Karen Zeese spoke here tonight at the John Connolly Forum on solidarity with Venezuela. And thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
And that was Willie Terry speaking with Margaret Flowers and Kevin Zeese at the James Connolly Forum last week about the sanctions in Venezuela. In our last segment, we have Schenectady Today host Anne Perillo, who spoke with Anastasia Garceau, director of the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center, about the museum's upcoming events on September 13th and 14th.
Very pleased to have Anastasia.
Yes.
Anastasia. Well, I mean, it's pronounced two different ways, so I want to make sure I get it right. Garceau, and she is the director of the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center. That's over in Waterford. And of course, they're by the river and everything, and you've got such a history. And activities are amazing. So let's first of all talk about what will I see at the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center.
I know, it's a bit of a mouthful. I got it all out. Yes, good job. Well, right now we have our summer exhibit, and that is A Place for Nature in Victorian Waterford. So it's a Victorian garden theme exhibit. So we have lots of flowers that are there. So we tell a little bit
Who
more.
Who takes care of that? You?
Yes, I do.
Oh, good.
Yep.
See? She's a hard worker.
I bring my brother in, so I got to keep him busy too. But he helps me with that to make sure that it's a nice space where it kind of looks a little bit like the original owner would have had with his flowers there, because we.
So you do a historical background as to what flowers would have been growing there.
Yep. You have an opportunity to shine some light on the original owner, which kind of gets overlooked sometimes because we're not in our original location. So
I heard you moved.
We moved
your building, huh?
Yep, 1964, when they were setting it up as a museum, they moved it to where it is now today. So we lost a few rooms. We lost a nice big conservatory that would have had all those flowers. So it's a way to bring them back in. And who doesn't like to look at flowers,
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So you have you have the garden.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any historical documents and things that you?
We do. We have a lot in our collection, actually, and we have our O'Connor Research Library, which you can make an appointment, come on in, and take a look at what resources we have.
We do get a lot of genealogy requests, but we don't really have a whole lot
there. You don't
have
a whole lot on there.
Right.
Yeah.
Our archive is a lot of, I look around, see what I can bring in, but it's mainly what people donate. So if your family donated something to the museum that had some particular family relevance to you, you're definitely welcome to come in and take a look, okay. And I'll be there for you.
Okay, good. Yeah. So they can contact you
absolutely.
On that.
Absolutely, I encourage
Let's talk about the events, because we have the flyers coming up, and I guess mm-hmm. what we should do is look at each flyer as it comes up so we can talk about the right one at the right time. Okay, let's talk about this, okay? Mm-hmm. This is what you were just talking about.
Right, so this is our exhibit, and that'll run until the end of October, our museum season, because we're a small museum. We kind of are only open for half the year. Doesn't mean we're not busy the other yeah. half. We have plenty of programs going on, but we have our exhibit open, and that is open Tuesdays through Saturdays, 10 a.m. to 3, and on Sundays, 12:30 to 3 p.m. And the admission fees that we do have do go directly to supporting all of our endeavors.
All of the activities. Mm-hmm. Okay, and the next one? Okay, and that's what it looks like probably inside.
That's what
inside.
It looks like
yeah.
right now with all our flowers in bloom.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next slide. Yeah, okay, now what is this? The porches? Is that what this
yeah,
says?
Yeah, so we're going to experiment and branch out with another program this year. This is the first year we're doing this. This is our Waterford Porch Crawl. So we're having a lot of local places, residences. Some of them are town and village sites. That people will go to kind of get a little bit of the history of the area, get a look at the architecture. We do have a wide range of architectural features that are throughout Waterford. It's a nice, quaint little area.
Okay. And if so you can include your porch.
Mm-hmm. And okay. if you would like to do that, we would definitely be more than happy to have you be included.
And what is this? Be a crawler.
Yep.
That's
so if you
a porch crawl?
Yep. If you want to join in with us, you come to the museum, you register, you'll get a little bracelet, and then you can go to all the different locations
okay.
and hear the history.
Cool. And what is the hops? I mean, there's a lot of hops being grown in this area.
Yes. Yes, there is. In fact, there was a lot of hops growing in this area way back when, the 1800s, and we had so many breweries. If you look around Albany today, you still have plenty of breweries.
Schenectady, they're popping up all over.
Yeah.
Really.
The home brewers, lots of that around here too. So this program will be by Roger Savoy. He is going to talk about
I know
about,
Roger yeah, very well.
Yep. He's a great guy. He does a lot of stuff with this, and he knows his stuff.
Yeah, he
so
does.
So he'll be able to tell us a bit about the area and kind of give you a feel for the development, you know, what's old is new again.
Yeah, and he does. He actually makes his own beer, and he has a little pub mm-hmm. that he mm-hmm. has there as well. But this event is not a beer associated, but it's talking about
no.
hops. And Sal, of course, that's my gal Sal, right?
Yeah,
mule Sal, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So this will be our third event for this, and this is a great fundraiser for us over at the Vanskeg Island Country Club, where we have a nine-hole program. We have lots of great prizes this year. We definitely had some nice surprises with what we have there for our guests who take part in
now,
this.
Are you, were you part of the Erie Canal? No.
Technically, because the Champlain and the Erie were built simultaneously and all part of the same system, and that's how it is today as well. So people could get through to the Erie Canal from Waterford or get off, as the case may be.
But you do have the locks, though.
We do. And so this is lock two. So this is the modern lock system, and it is, you can't quite see it in this photo, but just a little bit off to the right there by Unlocking History, our motto there. You would see the original Champlain Canal side cut locks from 1823 when it opened.
Mm-hmm,
so we have
okay.
the old right next to the new.
And what's this now? This is another event?
Yep, so this is our exhibit space to give you another look into what the museum is like.
Very nice.
You know, we're in a historic house, but we're not a historic house museum. So this is a nice way to kind of give you a feel for
sure.
what you're going to see, because we have a lot on the canals. Can't help but talk about them.
Absolutely.
But the people
and
there
the locks
as well,
and so, yeah.
because we have a lot of history in this area for the amount of time.
Amazing,
yeah.
amazing history. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in charge of all of this. Oh my goodness.
I am, and getting things like our little Waterford mule.
Oh, well, let's just take a peek at
yeah,
it. Yeah,
it's got our logo on it. It's the closest we can get to
unlocking.
A mule for
I love your logo, Unlocking History.
Mm-hmm.
because that's what you are doing, is unlocking
history.
Yes,
we are.
Yes. And is this a place that you would bring your kids, or is this more adult-oriented?
We do have a kids section. It is kind of small, but we're working on making sure that there is opportunities for visitors of all ages. So we do want to definitely welcome everyone that wants to come, but we do have a lot of focus on history that maybe an older crowd might have a little bit
more.
And
how much land do you have? I mean, is there an outside walking area?
We are connected. We don't own the land, but we are right next to the old Champlain Canal Trail, which is something that we have a lot of our boaters that come when they visit. They walk the trail, and it goes right to the museum. So it's a great spot to walk. There's some fishing. It's a bike trail, so it's a nice way to include us in your day
out. It's an outing.
It is.
So do a staycation, right?
Absolutely. There's a lot to see in Waterford.
There's a lot to see in Waterford and throughout our entire area. I know a lot of people can't wait to get to the Cape or can't wait to get to the Adirondacks or something, but you might be missing a lot of good stuff right in our area that you need to check out. And it's always when you go to many of these museums, and we have a lot of museums. Next week we'll be talking with the Saratoga Auto Museum. Whenever you go to those places, you end up doing an ooh and ah, because people come from other areas to see it, and it's right in our backyard, but we think we need to go somewhere else.
Yeah, my goal is to try and keep to the bare minimum the, I didn't know I had a museum here.
Yeah.
I lived down the street.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Oh, well, at least you came here
now.
Yeah,
I didn't know it was there. Yeah, I mean, people do that all the time. So I want to encourage people to check out the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center, and I got it all in this
time. Yes, you did.
Anyway, and if you happen to be listening to WOOC, you're hearing this right now, and we've been talking with Anastasia Garceau, who is the director of the museum, and it's a great place to visit. And I know Roger Savoy will do a great job on that hops thing, because he knows everything there is to know about hops. And
so definitely come to our programs, and don't forget that you can also be a part of them as well. We would always love to have more volunteers be a part of our community efforts, because every one of these programs really is a community effort.
Can they sign up?
Absolutely. We have.
And be a membership?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
We have membership and all that on our website, so please check that out as well.
And you just heard Schenectady Today host Ann Perillo speaking with Anastasia Garceau of the Waterford Museum and Cultural Center. For more information, go to www.waterfordmuseum.org.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Dave Pueblo. Our engineer tonight is Hannah Rowe. Did an excellent job. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. And remember, if you have comments, suggestions, or something you stole from the library as a child, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, dedicated to supporting jazz and nihilism in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org, or just stop by one of our weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.